You ever watch one of those television programs and at the beginning it puts a warning up and it sort of gives you a health warning that what you're about to see could be disturbing, or what you're about to see contains images that may not be, you know, whatever the wording may be. Now, don't be concerned or alarmed. I'm not going to show images or even describe images that would be alarming to the younger audience. But I do have to warn you, this passage really should rock our worlds. As I look at this passage, it deserves a sticker over it that says, be careful, because if you go here, you may find your entire world getting turned upside down. Which, of course, is true of the whole Bible, isn't it? That God is in the habit of turning our worlds upside down. We're in the Gospel of Mark, and we've been really spending these weeks looking at Jesus, looking at the way Mark presents Jesus to us. And the big question that is hanging over the whole thing is, who is this Jesus? And so this morning we came to the really, the turning point, the moment in the story where Jesus turned to his disciples and he said, okay, I've heard what the others are saying, but what about you? Who do you say that I am? And this is a key moment in the gospel, because Peter responds, you're the Christ, and then Jesus has to clarify some things. He's got the right answer, but he doesn't fully grasp all that that entails. There's actually two questions, I think, that are really hanging over the entire book of Mark. Now, the first question is, who is Jesus? And that question is fluttering in the wind the whole way through, and we need to be alert to that. But then the second question that follows naturally on from who is Jesus is this: what does it mean to follow him? Who is Jesus, and what does it mean to follow him? And in this section that we're going to look at tonight, which begins really where we finished this morning and goes on to the section that David just read to us, this section of three chapters, well, it really does deal with those two questions. In every chapter, it deals with those two questions. Consistently, it deals with those two questions. And the thing that strikes me about it is that actually those questions are very much connected. Depending on your view of Jesus, so will follow your view of what it means to follow him. If you've got the first question answered correctly, then there's a chance you'll get the second one answered correctly. If you get confused with the first one, the second one will throw you completely. In fact, if you want to know whether you've got the first one answered correctly, you could look at the answer to the second one in your own life and say, okay, what kind of a follower am I? Because my following, my followership, will demonstrate my view of the one that I'm following. You'll see what I mean about this connection as we look at these passages. This morning we were in chapter 8, and there was a story of a blind man, and that was the first blind man healed in Mark, and we're going to finish the section with another blind man healed. It's like bookends. Mark really wants us to see this section as a unit. And so just by way of review, what have we seen in terms of the first question, who is this Jesus? What we've seen is something, a picture, a portrait, a demonstration that absolutely turns everything upside down from what we would have expected. Jesus came and he did miracles, he did healings, he cast out demons, he dealt with problems, and people kind of like that. And yet Jesus kept saying, shh, keep that quiet, keep it quiet, don't tell anybody, don't go into the village, don't go back to your people, don't preach this, just keep it down. Because from his perspective, that's an incomplete picture of who he is. A Jesus that does good things, a Jesus that demonstrates power, a Jesus that can change situations. That's great, but it's not enough. And so Jesus wanted to keep that quiet so that when it came to the time when the disciples could finally say, you're the Christ, he could then immediately start explaining to them, okay, I'm going to Jerusalem. I'm going to suffer, I'm going to be betrayed, I'm going to be killed, and on the third day I can rise again. Now you've got some sense of what the Christ is about. And of course, they didn't get that, did they? And Peter starts rebuking Jesus, saying, no, you've got it all wrong, Jesus. Let me correct you on your theology. And Jesus had to rebuke Peter and say, get behind me, Satan. The way you're thinking is the world's way of thinking. And the world's way of thinking is exactly the opposite of God's way of thinking. Let's think about the world's way of thinking just for a moment. Maybe the simplest way to describe it is a way that we've described it in Cordeo. This was used as an illustration, I think, on the first day, and it's been referred to almost every day since. In the world, there's a pyramid. Everything is in pyramids. You know what I mean by a pyramid? That is, the higher you get, the better you are, the more you achieve, the higher you climb. Every system is kind of built that way, isn't it? There's lots of people at the bottom, very few at the top. It's true in all aspects of worldly society and culture. There's lots and lots of bands playing in garages down the back alleys of this country. There's only one at number one. It's a pyramid you have to climb. You go to the university, there's lots of cleaners. There's only one principal. Every workplace, lots of junior staff members. There's only one director, only one CEO. There are football teams all over the land. Every park has football teams on it. Amateur teams and Sunday league teams and Saturday league teams. But there's only one at the very top. And they don't get there by accident. They have to be the very, very best to get there. You see, that's the way the world works. It's all about climbing up this pyramid. And the higher you get, the less people there are, because the more special you are. And in order to get there, you tend to push others down. You go to the army barracks and have a look. There's lots and lots of privates. Very few generals. And it's consistent. Wherever you look, every sphere of the world around us works this way. It works with a pyramid. That is, the more power and prestige and position you can have, the better you are, the greater your value, the more you're worth. So what did Jesus come to do? Jesus came and he demonstrated unique power, didn't he? Power over the elements, the storm. He was able to walk on water. He was able to feed a multitude with almost nothing. He was able to heal the blind and the deaf and the dumb. He was even able to raise people from the dead. Jesus had power. And yet all the way through the first 8 chapters of Mark, he keeps saying, shh, I'm not climbing the pyramid. I'm not trying to prove myself here. This is not a demonstration for all to see. Think about the book of Psalms, for example. How many times in the book of Psalms do we read that God is exalted on high? O Lord, our Lord, how majestic is your name in all the earth. And Psalm 19, how does that one begin? The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day they pour forth speech. It's all about him. He's exalted, he's highly exalted, he's on the throne of the universe, of the cosmos. If there ever was a pyramid, well, put all the pyramids in together. There's one massive ultra pyramid, and God's right at the top of it, isn't he? God's sitting on the throne of the universe, sitting on the throne of all that there is. He's high, and he's exalted, and he's worthy of praise. And the same book of Psalms says, he humbles himself, and he stoops down to reach the broken. You see, when Jesus came, he wasn't actually doing anything radically new. He was just living out what they'd already seen, if they'd had eyes to see it, all through the Old Testament, that God is not some sort of glory monger. God is not all about his own glory. He's not all about his own position, his own praise, his own prestige and power. Now, as far as God is concerned, this pyramid is upside down. It's completely wrong. We've got it all twisted. It's been completely messed up ever since Genesis 3. As far as God is concerned, it's that way. And so when Jesus came, he didn't come to climb. He didn't come to achieve. He didn't come to show off or to receive glory for who he was or what he'd done. He came to humble himself, going so low, so devastatingly low that we can barely comprehend it, so devastatingly low that when he started describing it to Peter, Peter thought it was time to do him a favor and get things put straight for Jesus. You know, no way. Jesus, you must be glad I'm here because I can clarify a thing or two. No. You're not going to die. You're going to go to the throne. It's throne time, Jesus. And Jesus said, get behind me, Satan. You're thinking in the world's way. You see, God, he has this habit of completely turning things upside down. Actually, he puts things right side up. It's us who've got things backwards. It's our world that's really messed everything up, isn't it? Now, keep that thought in mind. Because the answer to the first question, who is Jesus, will have an awful lot to do with how we answer the second question, what does it mean to follow him? Because if Jesus is a pyramid climber, if Jesus is all about power and demonstration of that power and impressing the crowds, then guess what we'll try to do? We'll find ourselves falling into that same way of life. We'll try and be the impressive ones. We'll try to show off. We'll try to achieve. We'll go after power, position, and prestige. But if Jesus is really, genuinely humbling himself, surely that's going to transform the way we follow him. It's going to change our whole view of everything. And so that's what we're going to see in these three chapters. We're going to see in every one of these chapters, in 8, in 9, and in 10, every time Jesus tells them, I am going to be killed. I am going to be humiliated. I am going to die. This is what I came for. And we're going to see every time that he ties it in to them. That is, their reaction to it, what do you think it's going to be? Consistent or inconsistent? Will they get it? Will they understand what it means to follow Jesus? Will they understand that this pyramid is actually the other way round? That the goal is actually not to self-exalt, but to humiliate and humble ourselves? Well, I don't think they will. Now, obviously, I've read ahead. I don't just make this stuff up. Yeah, I've read ahead. But why do I suppose they won't quite get that right? Two reasons. Firstly, they haven't really done too well at understanding Jesus. It's taken them chapters, months, face to face, listening, watching, walking with. It's taken them a long time to get to this point, and already we've seen Peter rebuking Jesus. So they're struggling to understand that, but I'm not just going to give them a hard time. The other reason I think they will struggle to get the answer to the second question is because we do too. Okay, I do. And I suspect I'm not the only one. You ever find yourself thinking the world's way? Getting caught up in doing things to impress others, doing things to somehow, well, for the wrong motives. Of course we do. It's the flesh, isn't it? And so let's look. Let's trace our way through these three passages, three predictions, and we'll finish in chapter 10. That's where our main focus will be. But all the time we're thinking of these two questions. Who is Jesus and what does it mean to follow him? The kind of Jesus is to you will determine the kind of follower you are to him. So chapter 8, we've already looked at this, but let's just catch a little bit of that because you've got to see that Jesus really is trying to answer both of these questions. We saw this morning the prediction there that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again, verse 31. Peter rebukes him. Jesus rebukes Peter. Verse 34. Then he called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it. But whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. Notice how Jesus goes immediately from, this is what I've come to do. Okay, first question, who's Jesus? This is the Jesus that I am. This is the Christ that I am. You cannot have the Christ without the cross. You cannot have a Savior without the suffering. You can't have just some sort of miraculous ministry and manifestations. Now, you've got to have the full package, the mission of what Christ came to do. That's who Jesus offers to us. That's who he is. And so immediately says, if anyone would come after me, if anyone would come after me, the self-humiliating, dying, self-sacrificing, giving, lifting others up, if anyone would come after me, that kind of a Savior, well, then you need to take up your cross and follow. What does that mean, take up your cross and follow? Yeah, obviously, it doesn't mean wear a necklace, nothing wrong with that. But the idea of the cross as a nice symbol, a piece of jewelry, almost like a brand logo for the religion, that wasn't in their minds when Jesus said that, was it? They'd seen crosses. The word cross sent a shiver down the spine of a Jew. This was the way that the Romans, the ones who'd come in and taken over the land, the ones who had the ultimate power, the ones that kept them in chains as a nation, this was the way they dealt with the rebels, the thieves, the lawbreakers. They'd hang them on a cross. The most painful, brutal death, and visible to all. Today we sometimes hear of people being executed in other countries. Don't do it in this country, but in other countries, and they'll talk about a small select group of eyewitnesses. Now, that always strikes me as being a little bit uncomfortable. I can't say that I'd want to be an eyewitness of an execution, would you? And yet, all of these people would have been. They would have seen it lots of times. And so when Jesus says, take up your cross, that immediately conjures up all sorts of images, but it's not images of jewelry or images of logos or bright shining lights on top of big buildings on hills. No, it's images of death, images of sacrifice, images of no rights, no privileges. It's not about me. I'm giving up everything. If I'm taking up my cross, it's all gone as far as the me is concerned. Jesus says, take up your cross and follow. It's a real humiliating, sacrificial, no rights, no privileges, no pyramid kind of an image. So turn into chapter 9. Chapter 9, verse 30. They left that place and passed through Galilee. Remember, Jesus is heading for Jerusalem now. This is what we call a travel narrative. He's been as far north as Caesarea Philippi in chapter 8. He's heading for Jerusalem, so he's coming down through Galilee. And so they're passing through Galilee. Jesus did not want anyone to know where they were because he was teaching his disciples. This is what he said to them. The Son of Man is going to be betrayed into the hands of men. They will kill him. And after 3 days, he will rise. Look at verse 33. They came to Capernaum. When he was in the house, he asked them, what were you arguing about on the road? But they kept quiet. Just imagine them, 12 men, shuffling their feet, suddenly finding something fascinating on the floor. What were you arguing about, gents? They kept quiet because on the way they'd argued about who was the greatest. It's embarrassing, isn't it? Here Jesus has just been saying to them, I'm going to be killed. And next thing you know, he's asking them, what was that conversation about? And they had to admit, well, see, Jesus, there's this pyramid. And we were wondering, I mean, obviously we're pretty close to the top because you're the top and we're the 12. But we were kind of arguing because I was saying that there's got to be a 3 within the 12 and I'm in the 3 and he's not in the 3. And he was saying, yeah, I might not be in the 3, but at least I'm not in the 12 because I'm in the 6. And they're arguing about who was the greatest. And it just seems so ridiculous, doesn't it? Until we look at our own hearts and say, I probably would have been saying the same thing. You see, they hadn't understood. Notice the verse we missed, verse 32. They did not understand what he meant about his death and his rising again. And they were afraid to ask him about it because they didn't understand really who he was. They didn't know really what it meant to follow. And because their view of who he was still pyramid, they were still caught up in following as pyramid. Who's the greatest? Well, obviously it's Peter, James, and John. Oh, not so quick. Did you see how he spoke to me this morning? He told me something he hasn't told them yet. And the flesh is coming out and they're going at it. They're playing the game of power and prestige and position, even among themselves. And you've got to imagine Jesus just shaking his head as these men continue to struggle to grasp the answer to two simple questions. Who is Jesus? And therefore, what does it mean to follow? Sitting down, Jesus called them. He's going to teach them something. Take the position of a rabbi. He calls them over. If anyone wants to be first, he must be the very last and the servant of all. If anyone wants to be on the top of the pyramid, he needs to be right at the bottom. If anyone wants to be number one, he needs to be off the charts, not in the charts, not in the... If he wants to be top of the league, he needs to be non-league. I mean, Jesus is kind of... It just makes no sense, does it? But it only makes no sense because we are so saturated in the world's way of thinking. From Jesus' perspective, it makes complete sense because he, the one who has the right to sit on the throne of the cosmos, was willing to die the ignominious death of a criminal on a cross. And if they could grasp that, then they'd know what it means to follow. You come into chapter 10. I'd encourage you, maybe later on tonight, read through these three chapters and see how these themes weave their way through. Come into chapter 10, there's so many linkages that we could make, but I just want to jump right down to verse 32. They were on their way up to Jerusalem. That's where they're headed, with Jesus leading the way. And the disciples were astonished, while those who followed were afraid. What does that mean? Jesus is heading for Jerusalem, and they know that it's not going to end well. Even if they don't grasp what he's saying about what's going to happen when he gets there, they know it's not going to turn out well because they've seen the tensions already. They've seen what happens when people from Jerusalem come to Jesus. Now, Jesus is going to Jerusalem. This is going to be bad. And so Jesus is leading the way. He's not being dragged. He's not being forced. He's not being coerced. He's marching to Jerusalem. And the people around are just astonished at this. He is so bold. He's so committed to going there. And actually the crowds with him, they're a bit afraid. You would be, wouldn't you? It's like walking into a trap. It's like walking into the lion's den. And he's leading the way. He's so determined, so clear, so focused. Again, he took the 12 aside and he told them what was going to happen to him. We are going up to Jerusalem, he said. And the Son of Man will be betrayed to the chief priests and teachers of the law. They will condemn him to death and will hand him over to the Gentiles, who will mock him and spit on him, flog him and kill him. 3 days later, he will rise. I mean, this is more detail now. Surely now it's going to become clear. The penny's got to drop eventually, hasn't it? Oh, that's what you mean. That's the kind of Messiah you are. You came to do more than miracles. You've come to... Really? That's the kind of Messiah? Verse 35, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him. Teacher, we want to ask you to do for us whatever we ask. Would you do us a favor? Oh, you can see what's coming, can't you? Oh, no. Matthew tells us their mother was involved. That's really desperate. So the two brothers with mum come and ask Jesus, "What do you want me to do for you?" he asked. Let one of us sit on your right and one on your left. You know, right at the top. When you're right there, it's like, you know when you play snooker and you've got the red balls? You put one right at the top of the triangle, then there's two. Can we be those two? Oh, it's so cringy, isn't it? I mean, Jesus said, you don't know what you're asking. Okay, he says, can you drink the cup that I drink or be baptized with the baptism I am baptized with? I think what he's saying here is, can you experience what I'm going to experience? Can you go through what I'm going to go through? The cup I drink is going to be quite a nasty experience. Can you go through that? Can you be immersed into what I'm going to be immersed into? And they, probably not knowing what he means, say, yeah, we can. And he says, yeah, okay, you can experience what I'm experiencing, but to sit at my right or my left, that's completely missing the point. That's not for me to grant. That's up to the one who puts me there. That's up to my Father to determine. You are completely confused. Your pyramid is still the wrong way. Verse 41, when the 10 heard about this, they became indignant with James and John. And I suspect, knowing them as we do, it wasn't because James and John had asked an inappropriate question. It was because James and John had asked what they'd been wanting to ask. You got there first. Ooh, and you used your mother too. That's not fair. I was going to ask. I was going to ask tomorrow morning over breakfast. I'd planned this whole fish breakfast thing, and I was going to give Jesus his first, and then I was going to slip up next to him and say, hey, Jesus, hey, Thomas, got a question to ask. Hope you don't mind. I mean, they probably all planned it out. And so they hear that James and John have asked it, and they're indignant with them. And so there's this strife, this tension, the kind of thing you get when people are trying to climb a pyramid. You ever notice that? Isn't it a peaceful world out there? Isn't it a peaceful place? You know, at work where there's one director or one boss, one CEO, and then lots of people on the shop floor. Isn't it peaceful? How everyone gets on and everything's calm and comfortable and there's no issues, no tensions. Oh, you're the boss and I'm not. That's wonderful. Isn't it peaceful in the world of sport? Oh, we're only third in the league. That's okay because we just want to delight in the team that's first. No, that's not the world, is it? And if that's not our experience of church, maybe our church is too much like the world. If there's tensions and struggles and political battles going on, maybe we've got the pyramid the wrong way round. Could be true, couldn't it? That still we're trying to climb for power, prestige and position. And the tension is tangible. And so Jesus calls them together. He says, you know that those who are regarded as rulers of the Gentiles, the world, they lord it over them. Their high officials exercise authority. It's all about power out there. Not so with you. It's not to be that way. It's completely different among my followers. Whoever wants to become great must be your servant. Whoever wants to be first must be slave of all. Why? Because that's what I've come to be. Even the Son of Man, who is truly the highest and most exalted, even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve, and to give his life as a ransom for many. You see, if we haven't got the answer to the second question quite figured out, it's going to show. The evidence is always going to be there. It doesn't take long to spot it in yourself and certainly not in others. When we're trying to climb the pyramid, it gets messy. It gets broken. It gets fractured so easily. Power struggles and little cliques and groups and infighting and backbiting and gossip and all of those kind of things. It's all pyramid stuff. And Jesus says, look, if that's there, you're missing the answer to the first question because you haven't understood who I am. I, the one who's worthy of all servanthood, have come to be the servant of all. And if you'll really be captivated by who I am and what I'm doing, it'll transform your following. It'll change the way you live. It'll change the way you function as my followers. What's the church known for? Down through history, if you were to do a study of church history, doesn't matter whether you do it in depth or flying over the surface, you could almost do a complete study of church history, simply a study of power play, political struggle, division, 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 division. Maybe it's because the church hasn't really come to grips with who Jesus is. They haven't really understood what it means to follow someone who would humble himself absolutely and invite them to humble themselves too. This is the high point of Mark's gospel, I suppose, in some ways, isn't it? It's been building to this. If you read any book about Mark's gospel, I guarantee in the first couple of paragraphs, they'll say Mark 10:45. That's what Mark's all about. This verse, even the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. That's a summary of the whole gospel. And so surely now the scene is set. Jesus has got this crowd of people with him. He's heading for Jerusalem. He's dealing with his followers. And now, surely that's it. All we need now is to go from Mark 10:45 straight to Mark 11, verse 1. Now, Jesus came to Jerusalem. Fanfare, big crowds. Here's the moment Jesus has come to give his life as a ransom for many. Oh, wait, there's another story in there. Verse 46. I love the fact that this story's here because it doesn't need to be. At this point, we've got everything ready. Everything's in place. We just want to see Jesus follow through and do the ultimate. But Jesus stops for one more. Mark 10:46, then they came to Jericho. It's on the way to Jerusalem. And as Jesus and his disciples, together with a large crowd, were leaving the city, a blind man, Bartimaeus, that is the son of Timaeus, was sitting by the roadside begging. When he heard that it was Jesus of Nazareth, he began to shout, "Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me." Many rebuked him, told him to be quiet. But he shouted all the more, "Son of David, have mercy on me." Jesus stopped and said, "Call him." So they called to the blind man, "Cheer up, on your feet, he's calling you." Throwing his cloak aside, he jumped to his feet and he came to Jesus. "What do you want me to do for you?" Jesus asked him. The blind man said, "Rabbi, I want to see." "Go," said Jesus, "your faith has healed you." Immediately he received his sight. And did he go? No, he followed Jesus along the road. Simple little story. If you look it up in Matthew, you'll see there's actually two blind men. This is not a contradiction. If there's two, then there was one, right? There was two ones. That's how maths works. And so in Mark's case, he focuses in on just one of the two. And actually, he names him, which I love that. Why does Mark name Bartimaeus? You imagine being blind. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? You imagine being blind, and therefore you cannot work, and therefore you have to beg. And so every day, you sit in this place just outside Jericho, and you hear the movement of people. You can smell the fruit and all the smells of Jericho, and you can hear and you can feel the heat, but you can't see. And so all you can do is ask, "Would you please give me some money because I'm really hungry?" And more often than you receive coins, you'd receive cursing. You'd feel the spit on your face yet again. "Oh, I'm a nobody." People kicking you as they walk past, tripping over your feet, not even saying sorry, maybe even collecting some money, and some people are generous and someone else steals it and you can't even see when they do it. The ultimate in demeaning, the ultimate in absolute death in living form, like leprosy that we saw back in chapter 1. It doesn't get much worse than this. And Mark tells us that Jesus stopped and called him. Jesus had a crowd. He had a group with him. He didn't need another, but Jesus thought he did. See, Jesus cares for the ones. Jesus is so caring. I mean, isn't this what you'd expect? Not of somebody at the top of a pyramid, but somebody who's realized it's the other way round. And if it's the other way round, then the little people matter. The nobodies are important. And Jesus cared about this nobody. He said, "Call him. What do you want?" Treats him like a real person. Doesn't assume he knows, although it's pretty obvious, I suppose. But he asks him, "What do you want?" And the man expresses, "I want to be able to see." And Jesus says, "Okay." And he can see. I wonder why Mark gives us his name. I suspect. Here's my guess. I think it's because Bartimaeus was still around when Mark wrote the gospel. Still known in the church. You ever been to one of those camps? A week away, I don't know if this is a Christian thing only, but Christians tend to do this. You go away for a week together, and somebody takes lots of pictures. Now, on the last day, they have a little slideshow with some music playing. You ever been at one of those things, like a youth camp or something? And what happens? It's so predictable. The pictures come up, and people go, "Oh, it's me, it's me!" Ah! And they get all excited and nudge each other, and go, and all that kind of stuff goes on. I mean, it's so obvious what's going to happen. You've been there all week, pictures being... Anyway, you know, it's just normal. Now, Mark's gospel gets read out 30 years after the events. Isn't it beautiful that maybe four rows back, far left in the church in Jerusalem or wherever he was at the time, it gets to this point and there's a blind man called Bartimaeus, son of Timaeus, and everyone goes... And he said... It's me, it's true, it's all true. Yeah, it's just this embarrassed moment, but isn't that beautiful? That maybe Mark mentioned him because he's a real person, because he really went through it, because he really was a nobody, and now, by God's grace, he is a somebody. Isn't that the way the gospel works? That God takes nobodies like you and me, and he puts us together so that we can be embarrassed. Because Jesus cares about us. Imagine what heaven's going to be like. Imagine the slideshow then. And then I saved this one in Chippenham in 2011. Go on, it's me. Every one of us, we don't deserve this. We don't belong here. I can't believe I'm in heaven and I'm even on the screen. This is unbelievable. God, you're so gracious. That's what God's like, because he cares about the nobodies. Why? Because he chose to go to the very bottom to reach the nobodies, to become a nobody to reach the nobodies. Jesus isn't about power and prestige and position. He's about reaching the lowest of the low, the desperate, the broken, the weak, the hurting, the needy. The ones that cry out and everyone else says, "Oi, just cut it out, you're not important." Jesus says, "Yes, you are." And if you see clearly, like Bartimaeus could see clearly, then you follow Jesus. Just a little phrase at the end. He could see clearly, and Jesus says, "Off you go." Where's he going to go? He's going to follow Jesus. As Jesus heads to Jerusalem, Bartimaeus heads there with him. Here's the question for us. Do we have a clear answer to the first question? Do we see clearly who Jesus is? That Jesus is not about power and prestige and position, about self-glorification, about impressing people with all of his miracles. He's not about that. Do we see that Jesus is about being a servant of all? Of turning everything upside down, of being absolutely humble when we would expect absolutely glorious. In fact, his humility is his glory. That's exactly what our God is like. We've been so trained to think that if the world is all about climbing the pyramid, then surely God must be the highest climber of all. And God's saying through Jesus, "No, I'm not. I'm the one that's come down the farthest. Come with me. Because if you'll come with me, if you'll follow me, if you'll accept my death in your place and become a follower, I'll empower you to be a humble one too. I'll empower you to be an inverted pyramid person. I'll empower you to live out what it means so that the church doesn't have to be like the world." You see, if we get the answer to the first question right, the kind of God that we have in the Bible, the kind of self-sacrificing, self-giving, just lay it all out for the sake of the nobodies kind of a God that we worship. If we really are captivated by who he is, then it will show in the way that we live, in the way that we live out our Christianity, in the way that we follow. It'll show in our conversations in this place. It'll show in the interactions we have with one another. It'll show because suddenly, instead of being an organization just like all the others, pyramid climbers, climbing on pyramid climbers, power, prestige, position, backbiting, sniping, gossiping, hurting, taking, grabbing, instead of that, we'll be the opposite. We'll be lifting others up, esteeming others. Looking out for the interests of others instead of going after our own rights. Not gossiping, but affirming. not tearing down but building up, will be completely transformed if we are captivated by who Jesus is. The disciples didn't get it. Not in these chapters. But I think they did in the end. They did in the end when they had been used of God to spread a message of love all around the Roman Empire so that the empire was turned inside out, upside down. In fact, as Peter hung upside down being crucified 3-4 decades later, he considered it probably the ultimate privilege to follow a God who would die for him. How's your answer to the first question, who is Jesus? You can tell by watching how you live out your answer to the second. Who is Jesus? Have a look in the mirror and see the way you do Christianity. I suspect that many of us will have to repent, say sorry, ask God to forgive us, but He understands that. He knows that. He knows this is radical. He knows it's turning our world upside down. But that's what He invites us to. Do you see clearly? Are you prepared to follow Him?